and welcome to another episode of the Philly Sports Passion Podcast. I'm your co-host, Kyle Watts. Tonight with me is the showrunner and also co-host, Eric Jacinto. Eric, it's good to be back.
How are you today, Kyle?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. It's good to talk again. We want to get to the...
So I know we were talking yesterday after that tough Sixers loss, which we'll get into. But we were also, because of the Sixers loss was so tough, we were going over with several other people some of the toughest Philly sports losses for us over the past 25 years. I thought we could share some of those, and then we could share also the top 10 greatest wins, too. But since the Sixers loss was so brutal, I mean, it hits the rim and bounces four times, hits the backboard and bounces in. It was a freak shot. You know, it was pretty well defended by Simmons. We'll get into the Sixers in a second, but in no order, in the past quarter century in Philly sports, technically the one of my first one counts, since it was in the fall of 93, I'm going to start with the 93 World Series, Game 6. Blue Jays and Phillies, obviously the infamous Joe Carter walk-off home run off of Mitch Williams. That was one of the ones that sticks out. The Flyers, the Flyers 2010 missing puck clinching loss in the Stanley Cup Finals to the Blackhawks. The Flyers have that miraculous run, you know, get all the way to the finals after making the playoffs on the final day, come in as a seventh seed, make the finals. Probably should have had Patrick Kane as a Flyer in that draft a few years prior, and then the missing puck game. The Sixers loss on Sunday definitely rings up there just because of how talented and young this team is and how we've seen them kind of – they've kind of been our baby. You know, they've gone from, you know, young and undisciplined, and they've gotten a little bit better each year. I know I said to you that you know, that they didn't improve. Technically, they got a little bit better because they went the full seven games. For you, what are some other games, some other bad losses that stick out over the last 25 years in any of the sports?
You talked about the Black Sunday in 2003, the 2003 NFC Championship game against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the last game at the Vet, which still haunts me to this day, and probably a lot of Philadelphia Eagles fans, you included, that we were, double-digit favorites going into that game, I think?
Double-digit favorites in Tampa Bay. I think they only had one playoff win. Or they only had a couple playoff wins. They were, like, something crazy, like 1-30 in temperature, in games where the temperature was under 30 degrees, and it was right around freezing temperatures at the Vet that day. Obviously, we had beaten Tampa twice in the previous 3 years in the playoffs. You know, that Tampa Bay offense saw a little bit of a jump start when they got John Gruden instead of Tony Dungy, and I think that's really what did us in the mistakes. So that one's definitely up there. You know, some other ones are interesting. Would you put any recent Phillies losses up there, like maybe the 2011 Phillies Cardinals Ryan Howard game? Would that be up there for you?
Absolutely, that's my 1B after Black Sunday, because Doc was on the mound and we lost 1-0 in the first run. We scored in the first inning, and nobody else scored after that. I remember that game to this day, and it still haunts me. We had that team. That team won 102 games. We were the favorites to win the World Series that year, and we just couldn't score.
Yeah, so those,
one of those games where we.
One of those games where it was just. I agree with you. It you know, it was high emotions. It was at home. I didn't mean to cut you off, but we had our ace on the mound. We had the four aces, and we still had a. You know, to me, I think we still had a respectable offense. Another game, another Flyers game that was up there in terms of one of the worst losses was the last Eric Lindros game. It was game 7 of the 2000 NHL playoffs, the conference finals in the Eastern Conference, Devils, Flyers, obviously Flyers and Devils for on and off for like a decade had that, you know, pretty decent rivalry once the Devils got Brodeur and Stevens, and then the Flyers were up 3-1. It wasn't in a championship series like, you know, the 93 series or 2010 Flyers, but it definitely sticks out based on the Scott Stevens hit on Lindros and the fact that the team blew this big series lead. I think that's another one that definitely belongs up there.
Scott Stevens was Crosby before Crosby. He was the one of the most hated players in this city that I remember. I remember everybody because the Devils were our biggest rivals before Pittsburgh came back to life. Pittsburgh stunk for what, almost a decade before they got Crosby.
But they were bankrupt and they went through a lot of financial troubles when Lemieux retired. So the Devils and Flyers had that big rivalry. Stevens and Brodeur were at the nucleus. You had Scott Niedermeyer. You had some other guys, but they, you know, and you had the New Jersey
goaltender,
Marty Brodeur was their mainstay in net, and he was just very consistent. And the Flyers could, you know, rarely ever beat him, especially in the playoffs. They beat us in the 95 playoffs in that year, and then I believe once or twice more after that. But that series is definitely up there. You know,
definitely.
Are there any others for you over the past 25 years that stick out, especially among those?
Here's one that we didn't talk about. The 2013 NFC wildcard game against New Orleans, Chip Kelly's first season. Because didn't we miss a field goal that game or something that cost us the game?
Yeah, for some reason that stuck out. Yeah, that one was difficult. Another one that we didn't mention, I don't know that this one is in the top 10 for me, but it's probably close, was the 29 NFC Championship game versus Kurt Warner and the Cardinals. Arizona, I don't think they had ever won more than one road playoff game in their history.
Yeah.
You know, they were a team that I think they only won like 9 games that year. They had talent on offense, but the Eagles were heavily another game where the Eagles were heavily favored, and I believe they were at home too. Another game we forgot to mention so far that we also mentioned online with a couple of others was the Super Bowl with McNabb puking in the huddle. That was obviously in a championship game. New England was favored, but any championship game where you lose by 3 and you have a chance to win it on the final drive, obviously we got some retribution, you know, last year versus New England in the Super Bowl, but the puking game, I think that definitely, you know, belongs up there, as well as another recent game that's a little bit more recent was this past year's divisional round game in the NFC versus New Orleans. The Eagles, obviously defending Super Bowl champions. New Orleans had Drew Brees at home, one of the best teams in the league. And Eagles had a chance to go up in that game. For whatever reason, they decide not to wait until the 2-minute warning goes down. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that game belongs up there, the Alshon Jeffrey drop that led to the interception and loss?
That's my number 5 right on my list.
What are some other ones that you have on your list that are notable that we haven't mentioned yet before we get to the greatest games?
The 2004 NFC Championship game against Carolina, the first one at the link. That still sticks out because we were favorites in that game too.
Yeah, 14-3 loss. I remember that.
Oh, yeah, and About we mentioned the Stevens hit to Lindros. The Flyers lost
another
to
one,
the Stanley Cup.
another one that sticks out. Speaking of the Flyers, this also wasn't a championship game, but and the Flyers weren't favored in this game, but the Flyers are one of those teams that they've had a lot of near misses when it comes to making the finals. But the 0-4 Game 7 loss to Tampa, you lose by one goal. You know, you had a lot of they had a lot of injuries that year, but that team was, you know, pretty stacked. And Tampa Bay was a good team, but that was another, you know, crushing loss for a lot of hockey fans in this region.
Yeah, that's one I was gonna mention too. I don't think I have anything else that we didn't mention.
All right, so let's get into the for the time being, let's get into let's reverse that. And obviously, last night's loss it ranks up there as well. The Sixers, I call it the bounce game, that game-winning shot by Leonard. So we'll get now into the 10 greatest games or some of the greatest wins by Philadelphia sports teams, pro sports teams, over the past 25 years. Obviously, we have the Eagles' first Super Bowl ring last year versus New England. Obviously, like I mentioned, they gained some vengeance on Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and the Patriots after that 05 Super Bowl loss. Obviously, not the franchise's first championship, but their first Super Bowl, and obviously that big parade down Broad Street, and obviously the famous Jason Kelce speech, and the dog mask, a few others before I throw this to you that come to mind to me, at least recently, the Phillies 08 Game 6 World Series clinching game versus Tampa at home. Obviously, the first one in our generation, and then the first Philadelphia championship in nearly 30 years. Prior to that, and then a few others that come to mind recently over the past several years was obviously the 38-7 thrashing in the NFC championship game 2 years ago at home versus Minnesota, 38-7 at the link.
Yep.
The Atlanta win that same playoffs, they beat the defending MVP, the number one defense, and then the defending Super Bowl champion in the same playoffs. What are some that stick out to you? It doesn't have to be just recently, but over the past 20 to 25 years, some of the best wins.
The 2005 NFC Championship game versus the Atlanta Falcons. We finally win an NFC Championship game after going 0-1 after losing three straight. NFC Championship game. Was it three straight? Yeah, three straight. Three straight NFC Championship game.
If they're winning three, if you're losing three straight, so that was one. Do you have any others that come out to mind?
The 2000 epic five overtime thriller against the Penguins.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one. Yeah, Keith Primo. That was definitely one of the. That was one of the most non. That was one of the most thrilling non-championship wins for a Philadelphia team, even though it was in the playoffs. Obviously, five rounds. It set a record. It was like the third longest NHL playoff game ever. And it was obviously the longest in Flyers history. And then Primo has the five overtime winner versus Pittsburgh. That was in 2000. That definitely comes to mind. Obviously, some of the Phillies wins in that 08 run were notable, including the Matt Stairs home run versus the Dodgers. Obviously some of the World Series wins that we didn't mention. 2009 won versus the Yankees in game one. Cliff Lee dominates. That was definitely up there. We obviously had some regular season games we didn't mention, including Roy Halladay's 2010 perfect game versus the Marlins, and then he obviously had in the same year the in the postseason versus the Reds, the number one offense, the postseason no hitter at home. I think those definitely stick out. Did you have any others?
Oh yeah.
That come to mind?
The 2010 first round game four overtime win against the Bruins, on the way to the comeback of all ages, coming back from 3-0.
Yeah, 2010 game four, game seven was huge in that series too, because they had come back from three games to nothing in a series, and obviously the clinching game seven, the Bruins had taken a 3-0 lead. So they had taken a 3-0 lead in the series. Flyers had come back. And then in Game 7, when it looked like the Flyers had taken control of the series, Boston took a 3-0 lead in the Game 7, decisive game, and the Flyers came back and tied and won that game too. So definitely Game 4 in overtime. I believe Simone Gagné won that. And then Game 7, they came back and made history with that win too. That was definitely up there. I think another two big Phillies wins going a little bit further back was in the 93 playoffs prior to the Mitch Williams blown save versus Carter. There was two games. There was a game five of the World Series. I think this was in Toronto. Kurt Schilling threw a complete game, 2-0 shutout. And it was one of his best postseason games, arguably his best as a Philly. And then another game was the clinching game in the NLCS versus the Braves in 93, who had went to the World Series the year prior. So
yeah.
We'll wrap this up. Did you have any others, any other last-minute ones that you want to throw out before we jump into some Sixers talk?
I think we covered it. Do you have any more?
No, that pretty much comes to mind. I mean, we covered another one was the 4th and 26th game. That was huge.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Eagles and Packers in 04 in the divisional round at the Link. That was big. But, you know, We've gone through a lot of highs and lows over the last 25 years, so we're thankful that we at least have
two
championships to account for. So we'll jump into some Sixers talk. We've been talking about this extensively, and there's a lot to talk about. Sixers for the second consecutive year lost in the Eastern Conference semifinals, this time in seven games to Toronto, another division rival, compared to last year in five games to Boston. In Game 7 on Sunday in Toronto, Sixers lose on a game-winning freak bounce shot by Kawhi Leonard, 92-90 as time expired. Sixers are eliminated. Sixers outscored Toronto in every quarter except for that slow first quarter, and they actually shot better from the field. They shot just over 43%, and then Toronto shot just under 40%. So what really, I think, killed the Sixers was the offensive rebounding. Toronto was just really aggressive down the stretch. There's a lot to get to on this, but what are some things that stick out to you about the loss? Players, quote, anything that you can think of off the bat?
As you said, the offensive rebounding killed us, especially in the fourth quarter. You cannot let Kyrie Lowry get offensive rebounds when you have a 7'3" monster like Embiid there. And then the three shot clock violations, especially the one late, less than 2 minutes left with, in the corner where Jimmy Butler and they were trying to get to Jimmy, I don't know what Jimmy Butler was doing, but that's one that sticks out to me. You know which one I'm talking about, I think.
Yeah, there was three of them. There was nearly four. There was one where they just got a shot off and missed, I believe, with like a second left in the shot. So you practically you're in an elimination game. You're on the road. You're versus a team that had a better record than you, obviously, because of that. You're losing for most of the majority of the game, even though you're remaining in the hunt. I just didn't feel like I know the starters played a lot. It's tough because you want to give the starters enough minutes in a series clinching game, and Embiid played just over 45 minutes out of 48. So he played, he played the most minutes of the any member of the team, including the starters. Not only that, but you want to give them proper rest. I just don't feel like. We'll get to, some of the decision-making by the coaching staff, namely Brett Brown, in a few minutes. Yeah. But I just feel like they look burned out. But not to say that they didn't give it their all, but at times it just seemed like they were being out-hustled. Do you really think that the Sixers didn't look like they wanted it, or do you think they were just fatigued from playing so many minutes in a long series? What are your thoughts on the in this series alone, it was kind of back and forth in terms of aggressiveness. The pace was kind of similar, but as the series edged on, I feel like Toronto, especially in the decisive seventh game, they wanted it more. They had more total rebounds, 49 to 41. So before I ask you your opinion on the Sixers' effort, Embiid was only 6 for 18, so 33% shooting, but he shot well from 2. He was 5 for 11 from 2-point range, but he was only 1 from 6 from 3, but he made almost 90%, 8 of 9 from the free throw stripe. From the free throw line, and he had a double-double as well, and really, really played well. The Sixers really missed him when he was on the bench in this series, but I feel like you also have to give the starters the rest. It's not only the amount of rest, but it's at the right time, too. You don't want the team to go on a run. So before we get into anything else, I want to get your thoughts on the team's, the Sixers' effort, just rebounding and overall. In the seventh game, do you think they look tired? Do you think they just were outmatched? What are your thoughts on the pace?
I just think Toronto wanted it more. I said in the chat, in our chat, that it's going to come down to who wants it more, and unfortunately, Toronto wanted it more. Just wanted it more, and that's unfortunate because they did play hard and they played hard and they fought back, and they're lucky it didn't turn into an ugly game like game 5 because Toronto shot poorly too. So, but I give them credit. They did fight hard, but they didn't fight hard enough. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you think Embiid played too many minutes? Embiid out of 48, obviously it didn't go to overtime because of that shot. Out of 48 minutes, Embiid played 45 minutes and 12 seconds. Do you think the starters, Butler, Simmons, Embiid, and Harris, all played at least 42 minutes, and Redick, who was in the starting five, played 40 minutes? Do you think Brown decision making is at fault? Yeah, do you think he overused them in this game?
Let's see. What was the Toronto minutes?
Toronto minutes for the starters, Marc Gasol, 45 minutes, 12 seconds. Leonard, 43 minutes and 17 seconds. And then no other Raptor had more than 39 minutes. So most of the Sixers starters, actually all, I'm sorry, played over 40 minutes. Only a couple of Raptors starters played over 40 minutes. So Do you think that the Sixers starting five was overused by Brown in the game?
I'm going to say possibly Embiid. Maybe shouldn't have played as much as he did, maybe, considering his health history. And if it had gone to overtime, he would have been over 50 minutes. And who knows?
Yeah, that's true.
Who knows if it goes to another overtime? And then we don't know what happens. I mean, hindsight is 20/20. It's hard to say if he overused him because I think he was trying to match starter for Toronto and trying to match the minutes there. As you said, only two players played over 40 minutes for Toronto.
Only a couple of Toronto players played over 40 minutes. Gasol and Leonard. Gasol led the team in minutes with just over 45, and Leonard didn't really play all that great. He only shot 41%. He took almost 40 shots, but he was 2 for 9 from three. His stats weren't like overly flashy. He had a lot of points, but he put up a lot of shots. So he had kind of an Allen Iverson type game, did enough,
to get the win
with his speed and with his scoring ability. But I don't think he reached his ceiling in this game. I just think it was a lucky bounce. One thing I do want to say, much respect to Marcus Saul, because he's actually one of now my favorite non-Sixers for the gesture and the way he acted after the game. I don't know if you saw this, but as cameras were rolling on TNT, who was hosting the game after the final game-winning shot by Leonard and the game ended, the celebratory actions began by Raptors players as they were celebrating along with the fans. A lot of people, as you probably saw and heard, noticed that Embiid was breaking down crying. You know, it was a seven game. It was a hard-fought seven game, frustrating series. You lose it all in like a freak, shot as he was falling away. And then instead of celebrating with his teammates who were advancing, Marc Gasol with Toronto consoles and hugs Embiid. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that, but if you saw that, what were your thoughts on that and the gesture? And what were your thoughts on Embiid's emotions after the game?
I thought that was a good sportsmanship. He's a veteran, and much respect to him. And for Embiid, he was just emotional. I think it was the emotions of the last shot. Maybe he felt that he should have played a little better in the series. And I think he said in the press conference he felt he let the team down and the city down. And I think he's going to come out better than ever next year. And don't be surprised if he has an MVP-type year next year.
Yeah, his stats have improved every year since his rookie year. And, Simmons has gotten a lot of flack. I think some of it is warranted. I think some of it isn't because he's only 22. I mean, if he was 29 or 30, if he was like, even like late 20s and he was still playing like this and it hadn't matured as a player 7 or 8 years later, I could understand the constant criticism. But, I think pundits and I think fellow fans that are looking at it from a fan scope, you need to kind of give him a little bit more credit.
Anyway,
he's a young kid. He's fresh out of college. He's a nice kid. I think he played well at times. I think, you and Ryan and a couple other people talked about this, how both actually him and Embiid needed to be more aggressive and go to the paint in game seven. Simmons only took 5 shots and he had a flurry of turnovers. He actually had 5 turnovers and only 5 shots on 5 field goal attempts. in the game, and then Embiid took a lot of shots, but as you know, they were a little bit further away from the basket than a lot of people would have liked, but still a plus 10 in the series, in game seven. So the big question now, besides, you know, getting some of your guys under contract for the foreseeable future is, what is Brett Brown's future as Sixers head coach? I know me, you, and several other people have discussed this. We can go over it now. Obviously, Brown's been here for several years. He has experience as a successful assistant coach, winning multiple championships with San Antonio under Greg Popovich before being hired here. I know you're a proponent of keeping him around, you know, for maybe another year. Let me ask you this. Your thoughts as of this now, keep Brown or would you fire him? And if you keep him, would you keep him for another year, or would you kind of play it by ear? And what are your thoughts on his future as Sixers coach?
If we bring back everybody, I mean the starters, obviously Jimmy Butler and Harris, if they both come back, which I'm assuming they are, because we traded for them not to be rentals. And I would give Brown a one more year. And then if we don't get past the second round next year, then I would fire him. Because the starting final only played 20 games together. So
yeah, that's true.
I think a full season is warranted, but I understand the other side of why he should be fired, so I'm not totally against it, but I prefer him coming back. Because to me, there's really nobody out there to come in. But what are your thoughts?
Honestly, you know, as time passes, I'm kind of leaning towards bringing him back. I'm not a fan of Brown. There's several things I don't like about him as coach. You know, nothing against him. I think he's a nice guy. I think he's, you know, a very stand-up guy. But, you know, professionally, you want to put the best product not only on the court, but you want to have a coach that – I'm not saying he doesn't want to win, but you want to have a coach that not only is seasoned, wants to win, but also makes smart decision-making. Basically, you want to have kind of the best possible candidate, I guess is what I'm putting at. And I'm looking at it now. He was an assistant under Pop in San Antonio for almost a decade. You know, won multiple championships there. Obviously went through 4 years in a rebuild here. I believe at one point was an executive here, and then got just demoted to back to being the head coach, which I think is fine. I like Elton Brand. I think he's done a really good job. And like you mentioned, we have some free agents, some contracts to tie up. You know, if we want to keep some guys next year, if we want to keep this nucleus around and build around Embiid and Simmons. Although, you know, I think Butler had the best game of the series. You know, some of those shot clock violations were on him. So if he comes back, I would like to see the team work on getting the ball out faster. But as for Brown, you know, he was here through teams that lost more than 60 games. He's had good product out on the court the past 2 years. The big question with him is, has the team gotten any better? They had one fewer win than last year, 52 wins last year and 51 this past season. Obviously, like I mentioned, they lost in the same rounds, but won more games, more playoff games. So it's kind of a toss-up, like you mentioned. I think if there were more viable candidates out on the market there for a good head coach, you know, then it would be easier to look for a guy in his place. But I think for now, you know, the best bet is to probably, unless there is a candidate out there that we don't know of, the best bet is to probably bring Brown around, try to get guys under contract, and then maybe give him one more year, considering all that he's had to deal with. And like you mentioned, the amount of man games that were lost due to injury, due to guys sitting. So the question is, in addition to Brown, who do we bring back? Because there are several free agents. If you look at their payroll for next year, guys that are free agents have come in, Tobias Harris, Reddick, Boban, Mike Scott, Amir Johnson, Monroe, and I think Butler is under contract for next year, but for $19 million, but he's not here long term. The question is, unless you had any more comments about Brown, you had mentioned, you know, bringing Brown back and bringing some other guys back. J.J. Redick is getting up there in age. Obviously, he's been around. He's a viable shooter. He gets kind of touch and go. By the time next season comes, he's going to be 35. Would you bring him back? And if so, would it be on a one-year deal, or would it be a little bit longer of a deal?
I think it would be I would bring him back on a one-year deal, and I would ask him to come off the bench to be our sixth man, and I would start Zaire Smith, the guy that we drafted last year. I think Zaire Smith can help this team next year. He only played six games this year because he was injured. Go figure, right? But I think Zaire Smith can bring his athleticism to this team, and I think he can be a good two-guard because I think he can play both point and shooting guard. So I think he could be a good ball handler, too, on this team, another ball handler, where Simmons can maybe move four at sometimes.
Yeah, that would actually be an interesting dynamic to put Smith back in the lineup because, like you mentioned, a lot of people – forget about him because he played, you know, so little last year because of that injury. You know, the question is, some of the guys off the bench, you know, do they stay, do they go, or do you try to build the bench around free agency and the draft, and you know, go with, you know, what you've got based on the free agency market, and you know, how confident is the upper management in this year's draft. So that'll be another question to ponder as we get into this off season. So obviously, you know, Embiid, Simmons, even Smith is under contract up until 2023. So we have some guys, you know, that are here that we can build around. It's just a question of will the coach stay? I think we can agree on that. And will they build through the draft? Or will they add some pieces in the offseason? Obviously, there's going to be some crazy free agency rumors and trade rumors. But, you know, until we separate fact from fiction, you know, I think we won't obviously know what product we have on the court next year until we get into a training camp and, you know, 5 months from now. So did you have any other thoughts on the Sixers, on this series, before we dive into some Phillies?
Do you want to answer some questions from the Twitter? There's some.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's one
question. Did you have? Okay, and we'll fire off with the some of the questions, and people can actually. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but people can live tweet us as we go along in the Philly Sports Passion podcast at Philly STP podcast on Twitter. So, Eric, you had the first question.
Yep. This is towards Brett Brown, the Sports Opinion Podcast 30. I ask, do you feel that Brett Brown has some enough to remain the head coach of the Sixers? And if you fire Brett Brown, What do you feel the chances are of them convincing Jay Wright of Nova to leave Villanova to come to the NBA and coach the 76ers? What are your thoughts on that?
That's an interesting question. I think we talked about this, and I had to agree with you. I think it was you that mentioned this, but to kind of elaborate on what we were talking about and to answer your question, I think Jay stays at Nova. I think he's happy with his current deal. He's a Philly guy. He loves Philly. Don't get me wrong, but some guys, it's kind of the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's the kind of the way I look at it with Jay. He's getting paid good money. He's well respected there. He's one of the best, in my opinion, and not just being a Philly fan, but he's one of the best D1 men's basketball college coaches. So I definitely think he stays in the college ranks. I don't see him going anywhere. I think he wants to make his mark with one team, and I respect that. I think Brown stays here, like you mentioned, online, and I think you mentioned a couple other times in the past, there really isn't a huge market for head coaches, and it's really tough to go from college to the pros without having any experience. If I were to want to have Wright as coach here, not that he would be a bad fit, but I would want him to be a little bit seasoned as an NBA assistant before I have him dive right into the head coach. So
100%
I think Jay
agree.
Stays, I think Jay stays at Nova. Did you have any other questions from people on Twitter?
Yeah, there's two more questions. This is from Headlock Talk. With all the outgoings this season, what kind of talent would you look for to rebuild for next season? We talked about a little bit about that, like with Zaire Smith and being inserted to the lineup and re-signing JJ. Would you bring back Mike Scott, or as people would like to say, Prison Mike?
Yeah, see, it's tough because there's always going to be like guys out there on the free agency market that you can get for kind of similar price. This is a pretty good free agency. I'm looking at, according to HoopsHype.com, the upcoming 2019 offseason free agents, Kevin Durant, Kawhi, I know we talked about him, Kyrie Irving, who had a good season with the Celtics, 23.8 points per game, almost 7 assists, and he's a decent three-point shooter. Kemba Walker from Charlotte. They have Klay Thompson. I think he stays with the Warriors. They have Jimmy Butler. I thought Jimmy had 1 year left on his contract. I'll have to check on that. But D'Angelo Russell, obviously Tobias Harris, Kristaps Porzingis with the Mavericks. You really could go a number of different ways. It depends on if you want to get bigger, because obviously you have Boban. If you want to stay, with a number of guys that can really give you good size at the number five position. So, and you look at some other guys throwing out names here: Chris Middleton, Nikola Vukovic, DeMarcus Cousins. Then it's how about some of the top 15 free agents upcoming: Julius Randle, Al Horford, and a guy we just mentioned, Marc Gasol, who, although he's getting up there in age, makes a good amount of salary, would be a decent addition. I see it kind of being a hybrid where we both build around some of the young guys, but we add pieces here and there. I would be surprised if we added, unless like a guy like Kawhi really wants to come here, I really would be surprised if we added like a top three or top five free agent, unless they really like hop in our lap. Otherwise, I see it. I see it more as a retooling. More than, it's not a rebuild, obviously, but I see it's kind of retooling and adding pieces around some of the stars we have, like Simmons and Embiid, and I think Harris probably comes back. I think Butler will come back, and you know, some of the other guys, Mike Scott, you mentioned, and to answer that question, I would be surprised if he comes back, because we have some younger guys that can kind of fill in for him. So what are your thoughts on the off season and some of the guys that we have?
That's actually the third question with that, because Butler can opt out for a max deal, and I think Tobias can get a max deal too. Those two are a priority. But if one of them we can't resign, then I would try to go after as you said, maybe Kemba, and maybe then move Simmons to the four. What do you think of that idea?
Yeah, that's a decent idea. And you know, honestly, obviously, you know, a lot of guys are going to be attracted to top dollars. So, like I said, I really this year Durant made $30 million, Kawhi made 23. So I Kawhi, to his career, hasn't made as much as a lot of other guys. Obviously, athletes have gotten a little bit greedy, but considering the market the way it is, you know, obviously, like we saw with, you know, in another sport with Bryce Harper, is Bryce Harper worth that kind of cash? No, but to get talent and to kind of put a formidable lineup, you know, on the court, you really might have to splurge. But with this type of team, you really, they're not that far away from the championship, honestly. It would have been interesting to me if they had won that game seven. I think Milwaukee probably would beat us, and not just because they were the best team in the conference. I just think they stack up better. They're a little bit deeper.
I think they would have won.
They have a better coach, and coaches can definitely win, can definitely steal you a game in the playoffs. And obviously you can't afford to lose any games in the playoffs in any round. That's where I really think Nick Nurse for Toronto, I think he's a decent coach, but I don't really think he outcoached Brown. I think Brown really kind of screwed himself. I think he kind of shot himself in the foot is what I was trying to think of. I think he really made mistakes on his own doing rather than anything that Nick Nurse might have done in a game in terms of matchups or whatnot. And I really think Brown in this offseason needs to work on timing his timeouts correctly. I know in the playoffs, you know, it's quick. You know, refs can't hear you because of the crowd noise. There's a lot going on. But that's when you really, you know, and I believe in game six, he waited until, I could be wrong, but I believe it was a 15-0 Toronto run before he took a timeout, and that's inexcusable. You know, that's when you wait. That's when you, let me just say this. When it was a 6-0 or 8-0 lead, that's when I would have called a timeout and try to restructure and go over the playbook and try to refocus. So I don't want to get too off topic, but did you have another question from a fan on Twitter?
That was pretty much it, because the last question was pertaining to Jimmy Butler and Tobias Harris, and that comes from In the Raptors podcast.
Okay. Yeah. I think it should be interesting. Obviously, to me, if I had to sign one of the two, I would go with Butler, who I just think is talented in multiple facets. I think he can play multiple positions. But it should be an interesting offseason for both the Flyers and the Sixers. We want to, unless you had any more comments on the Sixers, I wanted to segue into some Phillies. Phillies have obviously had an interesting a few months. Did you have anything more to add about the Sixers?
No, but not really. It's going to be an interesting offseason. There's going to be a lot of chatter, especially the big one today that came out, the LeBron for Simmons, which I think is ridiculous because I wouldn't trade a 22-year-old for an aging LeBron James. 5 years ago, sure, who wouldn't? But LeBron James is, I mean, LeBron James is a drama queen. Let's put it that way.
I think he really has a big ego, and I think a lot of times he's motivated by the wrong things. I've learned to kind of cut out a lot of that fat in terms of those crazy trade rumors. I agree with you that it's going to be an interesting, busy offseason for several, and it has been so far for several teams in the Philadelphia area. So we'll segue into some Phillies who are in the middle of their season, leading the division at 23-16. Obviously, they've had a busy past several months, getting Bryce Harper, getting JT Realmuto, obviously Gene Segura, who recently just came off the DL, Andrew McCutchen, David Robertson, and then moving Reese Hoskins back to his natural position at first. The team's playing Milwaukee now and losing 4-2 after a rain delay at home. That game's in the middle of the fifth. Phillies have had some. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Okay. Phillies have had some interesting pitching problems this year, but they've also had some guys come in. And Cole Irvin the other day made his major league debut and pitched a solid outing. I think Hoskins is thriving back at his natural position. He leads the team in home runs and I believe in OPS as well. And he's for a cleanup hitting slugger who, is still young enough and still in the prime of his career. Hoskins is hitting .286 and we're almost, 50 games into the season. I want to start out, since obviously this was the talk of the offseason, with the signing of Bryce Harper. Obviously, we got him to a mega deal this year. He's hitting .229, 7 home runs. He had a grand slam last week in St. Louis. Phillies, like I mentioned, are leading the division. Harper is one of the league leaders in walks. Has 31 coming into today, and he has an OBP right around .376. What were your thoughts on the Harper signing, and what are your thoughts so far? Harper's played the entire 40 games so far into this season. What are your thoughts on Harper so far, 40 games into his Phillies career?
I think he's been solid, but I think he needs to obviously cut down the strikeouts, but he's a power hitter, so that's going to be, at least he's trying, with the strikeouts, it's a lot of players strike out these days, so it's iffy. I know people complain about the strikeouts, and I understand that, but he's a power hitter, and he's going to strike out. Hoskins strikes out. Howard used to strike out, 200 times a year. And players strike out. It's just part of the game. And the weather hasn't been even warm enough. So once he's going to carry us once he gets hot. And right now the pitching is carrying us with our with our young pitching. Besides, I mean, Nola had a bad outing tonight, but that was probably because of the rain delay. But I think he's been a solid signing so far, and I love him on the team. Segura's been a solid signing. McCutcheon's been a good signing. He's a good leader. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and another thing I want to add, another dynamic. Some of these guys that we added also had the dynamic of winning. Harper made it to the playoffs on several occasions when he was in Washington. Never made it to the World Series, but he has playoff experience. McCutcheon made it there, I believe, with both Pittsburgh and the Yankees. Obviously, Robertson has been there with the Yankees.
Yep.
And then, obviously, we saw Segura. I think he, in terms of his value, he adds that speed and plate discipline at the top of the lineup. The team, the lineup especially, really missed him in his absence when, like I mentioned, he had that disabled list stint earlier in this year. But one thing I want to get to, I know I mentioned the pitching. Some of it's been surprising in a good way. Some of it's been surprising in a bad way, and some of it's been kind of guys that you've expected of, you know, their roles, both good and bad. Before I get to the pitching, we mentioned Harper, and one thing I do want to add, while he has struck out a lot, I would like to see him up his average a little bit. His plate discipline has always been one of his best qualities as a hitter. Like I mentioned, he's one of the league leaders, and he's always nearing a 400 OBP when he's having a good season. But, you know, if you look at strikeouts as just another out, I would like him to see to it that he improves his average a little bit, even if it's in the 270, 280 range, like right around where Hoskins is. That, like you mentioned, though, we're still, you know, like I mentioned as well, we're not even 50 games into the season. We're a good chunk into it, but we still got over 120 games left in the season. So 75% of the season hasn't been played yet. But before we get to the pitching, Harper this offseason obviously signed the mega deal with the Phillies after spending his entire career as the number one pick with Washington on March 2nd. So a little over 2 months ago, signed the crazy 13-year, $330 million contract with the Phillies. The deal set the record for the largest contract until another Philadelphia guy, Mike Trout, signed a deal over $400 million with the Halos. Harper wears number 3 out of the club since he respected the number 34 that Harper wore with the Nationals, was worn by the late, great Roy Halladay. What were your thoughts on both the deal itself, the amount of money, as well as Harper choosing not to go with Halladay's number in honor of Halladay? What are your thoughts on both of those?
I respect what he did, and I like, I mean, I think his new number fits him well, number 3. I think he just wanted a new number. I think a new number for Philadelphia because he's going to be here for 13 years. So I respect what he did, and he even respected Franco not taking the number 7 because originally number 34 added up to Mickey Mantle, one of his father's favorite players from the Yankees because he grew up a Yankee fan. So he respected Franco and didn't take number 7, so he decided to take number 3, which I think is because of Babe Ruth. I don't know if he said that, but I think it's because of Babe Ruth and his father and brother wore number 3 too.
Yeah, so he obviously, you know, chose to forego wearing a couple of different jerseys jersey numbers. You know, Babe Ruth was number three with the Yankees, and like you mentioned, Harper's family has Yankee ties, obviously, and to pay respect to, you know, some of some guys that either play for the Phillies now or former Phillies, and Halliday and Segura. So as far as the money itself, do you think the Phillies overpaid for him?
I think they did what they needed to do to sign him, because it was a mega signing, and he is a star off and on the field. Obviously, with the jersey sales, after 24 hours, they broke the record for most jersey sales. So he does a lot for this organization off and on the field. Sorry to interrupt, but they just tied the game at four. Cesar Hernandez hit a 2-run home run to tie the game in the bottom of the fifth.
Oh, okay. All right. So Phillies were down at 1.4-1 to Milwaukee, who's also has a winning record, 24-18. Now it's 4-4 in the bottom of the fifth. That's good for the live update. I want to get into before we switch top Phillies topics. One last thing I want to mention on Harper. I think commenting on both his talents and the money at the time, it seemed like a lot of money. It still obviously is, but for the market, some other team, whether it be re-signing with Washington or another team, was going to pay him that amount of money. So the Phillies were committed to winning, you know, and I think he's a guy that has a good hybrid of both, you know, speed, a little bit of speed, but mostly power and arm strength and just overall athleticism. I mean, if you look at his stats, 8 years in the league, one-time MVP in 2015 with Washington. He's made six National League All-Star teams, Rookie of the Year in 2012. He was also the Silver Slugger, his 2015 MVP year. Led the league in home runs with 42 that year. Per 162 games, he averages 32 home runs, 92 RBIs, and his OPS is near 900. And he's led the league in walks last year with 130, and he's leading the league this year in walks. So, so far, he's been, I think he's been, you know, in some ways, the main gate attraction. He was on MLB. He was on several different publications, and then he was on MLB The Show too. And then he's been on several different baseball cards, and obviously ticket sales and jersey sales have been through the roof, memorabilia in general. So, as we continue to discuss the Phillies. Pitching has been kind of interesting. Aaron Nola has gotten off to a rocky start. I've missed some games. I don't know if he was injured, but so far he's 3-0, but he has a ERA over 4.57 ERA and 4.82 fielding independent pitching. And he's allowed almost 10 hits per nine innings. This is Nola. Zach Eflin has been their best starting pitcher, 5-3, 2.47 ERA, leads the team in innings pitched with 51, and he has a whip, a walk, and hits divided by innings pitch right around one. What are your thoughts on some of the starting pitchers and the pitching staff in general? Do you have any comments on guys like Eflin? And Nola, who I just mentioned, and Arrieta, who's, you know, trying to bounce back after, you know, a season in which he was injured, and then Vince Velasquez is on the disabled list. And then if you add in Jared Eichhoff, who's been pretty good as well, Speak to some of your thoughts on some of what the starting pitching has done and what they haven't done so far.
Aaron Nola, I don't know if it's time to be concerned, but he only pitched 3 innings today. It's probably because of the rain delay, obviously. But I've seen some, I mean, he gave up 3 runs today, and now his ERA is up to 4.86, as he said. He gave up a home run. So I guess he was a little shaky today, but I think that was because of the rain delay. Zach Gaflin, as you said, has been our best pitcher. He has 2 complete games, which leads to MLB. He's the only pitcher in MLB that has 2 complete games. I said in my preseason post that he would be the breakout pitcher of the year for the Phillies. So far, so good. Knock on wood. I think Eichfert has been pretty good. I think he's pitching tomorrow, so he has an ERA of 1.5, I believe, in, I think, 3 or 4 starts, but he's been our second best pitcher. He has 31 Ks, which is pretty good. And then you got Cole Irving, who pitched yesterday afternoon. He pitched 7 innings, gave up 1 run, and had 5 strikeouts, and 23 of 28 batters were first pitch strikes.
He's very impressive.
He's a slider type guy. He uses slider a lot. Slider and changeup, I saw, and it showed the percentage. And it was like slider and his changeup are his two best pitches. Did you see any of the game yesterday for him?
I saw the highlights. I was impressed with his breaking ball. I really like the young arms on this team. I think Nola will come around, and it kind of speaks to your point that, you know, it's so early on in the season. You know, guys, you know, they may have – it's tough throwing, you know, when it's cold and wet out, and, you know, it's May and it's raining. And like you mentioned, there was the rain delay, so he had the short outing today. I'm not concerned about Nola because he has a reputation, and he's been consistent for pretty much the majority of his career. I still think he's the ace of this team, but I really like what some other guys like Eichhoff have done. And then Irvin had that really impressive start yesterday. You know, we played well versus some really good teams. I really hope we continue to beat the bad teams. There's no reason we can't sweep teams like the Marlins, who I think are like a minor league team on paper. They're a major league team with a minor league roster. And like you mentioned, if we keep winning, you know, majority 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 4 of some of these series, you know, there's a good chance we can take the division this year.
Yep.
Coming into today's game, we were, I believe, several games ahead of the division. We were actually 3 games ahead of Atlanta coming into today. Atlanta is 21-20. The Mets are 19-20. And Washington and Miami are obviously further down down below in the pecking order in the division in the NL East. And then, it's been pretty interesting. The young arms have been probably the most exciting thing to see besides the new faces. Like we mentioned, the Harpers and the Real Muto, who I think, you know, we really needed a catcher after Chooch left. There was a big vacancy there. One quick thing tomorrow. You just mentioned this, but I'll for everybody listening and for all the Philly fans out there, pending a rain delay, we're not supposed to get showers tomorrow night, but tomorrow, 7:05 start at home versus Milwaukee. Eichhoff's going to go versus Brandon Woodruff, who has a good record, 5-1, but ERA over 4. And like you mentioned, Eichhoff has a sub-2 ERA this year. and a winning record. And he went 8 scoreless innings last week in St. Louis in relief and didn't allow a runner to reach scoring position until the 8th inning. So I've really been impressed with him. I think, you know, guys like Nola, and I think Arrieta, you know, despite the fact he's had some injury problems and he's getting up there in age, I think he comes back around too. One thing we continue with the Phillies, there was a recent tragedy in the Philly family, in the Phillies family specifically, a longtime businessman and Phillies executive chairman, minority owner, and these are all former titles, and former president of the Phillies, good guy, David Montgomery, recently passed last Wednesday, May 8th, at the age of 72. He was once known as the president and CEO of the Phillies. So Eric and I will have a brief moment of silence for him. We'd like to give a before we continue the podcast, we'd like to give our well wishes to his family, and may he rest in peace. So we'll have a quick moment of silence for former Phillies owner David Montgomery. All right, and Montgomery suffered for a while. Had 3 children, lived with his wife Lynn, 3 grandchildren, and a half a decade ago was diagnosed with jawbone cancer, underwent surgery, and then unfortunately succumbed to the disease and unfortunately died from it last Wednesday morning. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Eric, but I just wanted to throw that out there real quick. I know you're a big baseball guy. And then you saw the loss of Montgomery. Obviously, you've been a fan for a while, and he's been kind of at the thick of Phillies baseball for a while. So it was a tough loss for Philly sports, for a guy that was really passionate. I think he was more invested in the team from a winning standpoint than Bill Giles, who was more from a business standpoint. But do you have any thoughts before we continue further on the Montgomery passing, or
let me rest in peace and thank you for all he's done for the organization, and thoughts and prayers go out to his family. And I compare him to Ed Snyder. I know you're a big hockey guy, so I think he's Ed Snyder of the Phillies. So if that's a good comparison, when Ed Snyder passed away a couple years ago, so. May both
absolutely.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, both two guys that really made an imprint on the Philly sports landscape. Obviously, Ed with the Flyers. Obviously, Ed, helped build the Spectrum. And then, obviously, we all know what Dave Montgomery did, helping to try to get along. Obviously, helped build a beautiful ballpark in CBP. And, he really did a fabulous job. And I think you really touched on it well. You know, his contributions were huge and really tough to put down on paper just because of the amount of work he did in the community and on paper and behind the scenes for Philadelphia sports. So with that being said, if we wanted to switch subjects, we wanted to get into some Eagles off-season news. This off-season, Carson Wentz was looking to rebound from another injury-plagued season, lose Nick Foles to Jacksonville. We get DeSean Jackson back from Tampa Bay. We've had an interesting off-season so far, and I really think this team can bounce back next year after a disappointing loss that we mentioned, that crushing NFC divisional round playoff loss at New Orleans last year. Is there anything that sticks out to you about this Eagles offseason so far? A signing, a loss in free agency, something in the draft, any type of news that you want to start off the bat with?
I like the Howard trade. I mean, obviously we stole it up in the Bears. And I like the draft pick of Robinson from the Penn State. I think those two are going to be a good 1-2 combo for the Eagles. And I like the wide receiver that we drafted. I think he could be a good solid third receiver unless we move Nelson. I mean, obviously we have Sean Jackson too. So I think he could be a good fourth receiver instead of third. I forgot about Sean. And I think we just recently signed a quarterback to be what was his name?
We signed him yesterday.
No, the other guy. We signed him yesterday or something.
Are you talking about Perez?
No, I think wasn't there a quarterback they signed yesterday? I forgot. Let's see.
Honestly, the last couple of days I haven't been watching it just because of Sixers. But I'll run down some of the free agent signings. Some of which were re-signing. Some of which were free agency signings. Richard Rodgers, the tight end, who was injured last year, signed for 2 years and just under $2 million. Nate Sudfeld, Carson's backup at QB, signed a 1-year deal. We lost Golden Tate to the Giants on a 4-year deal. Mike Wallace and Chance Warmack are still unrestricted free agents, but we signed, re-signed Wiz, Stefano Wisniewski, which was huge. I think Darren Sproles, I think he's an unrestricted free agent, and his future is still to be determined because he wanted to retire a couple years ago, but he got injured, and he wanted to retire on his own power when he was healthy. Yep. He's soon to be 36 years old. Obviously, he has a couple Super Bowl championships, so, you know, he's not like he's going to retire, not without a title. Actually, he only has one. I'm sorry. I thought he won one with New Orleans. But we lost Jordan Matthews to the 49ers, re-signed Timmy Jernigan to a 1-year deal, lost Jordan Hicks to the Cardinals, Brandon Graham, which was a huge signing. Obviously, he was very pivotal over the last several years. We know what his contributions were in the playoffs, obviously, in the Super Bowl. Nick Foles, like I mentioned, signed a 4-year, $88 million free agency deal with the Jaguars. I don't think really people were surprised by that. Nick wanted to be a free agent. And then this was Carson's team, despite the injury. Re-signed Jake Elliott, who's been really key, made some huge kicks, some really clutch kicks over the past couple years. Ronald Darby, and then obviously we also released Chris Maragos, and then some other guys as well. We traded a 6th-round pick in the draft to Tampa for Deshaun, and a 7th-round pick in next year's draft. We traded Michael Bennett and a 7th-round pick in next year's draft to the Patriots for a 5th-round pick in next year's draft. Two more trades. A 6th-round pick we traded in next year's draft, which could be a 5th-round pick in a conditional terms in return for Jordan Howard, which you mentioned. I think that was a huge pickup. And then lastly, just under a few weeks ago, we traded a 7th-round pick in this year's draft for nose tackle, I'm trying to say his name, Hassan Ridgeway from the Colts. And then in the draft, like you mentioned, we got Dillard, Andre Dillard, the offensive tackle from Washington State. A couple of things I want to get to. The trades were some that stuck out to me. Obviously, losing Foles was huge, but we still have Wentz. But getting a guy like Deshaun back, who obviously has familiarity here, obviously has familiar with the West Coast system, the West Coast offense under Andy, and Doug runs a similar system. And obviously, there are similar familiar faces that were here when Deshaun's first stint here, obviously drafted here in 2008 and spent 6 years here from 08 to 2013, went to Washington, Tampa, and then he's back here. What were your thoughts on the loss of Michael Bennett, who spent 1 year here, and then the reacquisition of Deshaun Jackson? Did you like those moves?
I was fine with Michael Bennett. I think he was an okay addition last year. Deshaun Jackson, I like Deshaun Jackson, but I question how much he has left, but we shall see. But he is up there in age. He's, what, 33?
He's 32, but 32? During the end of the season, he'll be 33. He's getting, he's been in the league for over a decade now. He had a decent last year with Tampa. He played only 12 games, and still had, even though he only had 40 catches, he led the league in yards per reception, and he had almost 800 yards. He only had 4 touchdowns, but obviously, you know, it's a combination of what the defense gives you, how good the quarterback is too, because Jameis Winston in Tampa Bay, where Deshaun was last year, I wouldn't say he's the worst quarterback, but he's not. I don't think he's an above average quarterback, despite where he was drafted. And Ryan Fitzpatrick played some there and had some decent games, but I think it's obviously a huge step up when Carson is healthy. He's one of the most accurate, and he's one of the most dynamic and difficult to defend quarterbacks in the league, because obviously we saw in his MVP caliber year a couple of years ago before he went down, he can make a play with his legs and with his arm, and he was
hello. I think we lost Kyle there. We'll wait to see if he returns. I'm not sure if we're still live. Hello? I'm going to wrap up the show. Thank you for listening. There were some technical difficulties with Kyle. We apologize for the technical difficulties. And we'll see you. Just follow us. And thank you for following us on Twitter at Philly Sports. Philly SP Podcast. That's Philly SPP Podcast. And follow me at Big E Jacinto, and follow Kyle at Kyle_Lutz. And we'll see you next week. We'll be doing shows likely on every Monday. And thank you for listening. And have a good night. Bye.